Those little books, you know, though generally accurate so far as they go, frequently fail to convince the average reader, because whether he consciously formulates his objections or not, he finds it difficult to believe that a mere bum and unbalanced misfit like Marx, or a third-rate college professor like Weishaupt, could have ruined the Western world, no matter how cunning and malevolent he was. And the average man, even though he may have made no formal study of history, has an impression that before 1776, the world wasn't quite paradise even before Weishaupt. With race as an issue, you don't need books. The very forces that your enemies have set in motion are working for you every day to convince your neighbors and friends that you are right. Just as an example, I mention a trivial little incident of which I was told on the telephone while I was writing the preceding page of this speech. It is, of course, just the sort of thing that's happening all the time, but it's typical. In a medium-sized industrial town of Illinois, a lady went shopping in the town's best department store, taking with her her little boy. While she was there, she sent him into the men's room and waited outside the door for him. After a while, two well-dressed and prosperous young Negroes emerged, but no one else. Finally, she summoned the manager, and they found on the floor of the washroom the body of her little boy. He had been killed by stuffing paper down his throat, and his sexual organs had been amputated and taken away by the savages. Now, of course, so trivial an incident should not have been mentioned in the local newspaper in the interests of racial harmony. But word got around. The mother, who may have been what's called a bigoted racist, told her friends, and the local police, with that awful brutality for which they are now so condemned in the press, confirmed the story to inquirers. The news got around. And believe it or not, ladies and gentlemen, it was much more stirring than even 50 booklets that explain the errors of John Maynard Keynes. That also is the kind of fact that even the cleverest liberal intellectual cannot refute. He does not dare publicly to rub his hands with satisfaction at the progress of brotherhood and civil rights. So all that he can do in public is take refuge in the explanation that the savages were underprivileged because they had to drive a Cadillac instead of a big Mercedes-Benz. Now that explanation may satisfy his fellow intellectuals, but it really fails to convince those vulgar Americans who work with their hands for a living. The race war is now open and declared. And it is conducted on a present tactically on a principle that a riot a day keeps the white man away. I have long believed that the race war was the one strategic blunder that our enemies have made, the one major operation in which they let emotion direct them rather than reason. It is the one area in which they cannot, with their usual dexterity, retreat temporarily from that salient to attack a weak spot at the other end of our lines. The hatreds that they have aroused in the savages cannot be controlled or deflected, as is obvious by the failure of the most desperate efforts in Washington to postpone all riots until after the coming election. The only thing that has thus far averted massacres of white men and the burning of white residential areas is the savages' understandable reluctance to use the great stores of arms and ammunition that American taxpayers have provided for them under the guise of Lyndon's War on Property and similar hoaxes. A reluctance to use those stores of arms and ammunition before the administration has succeeded in depriving the hated and despised white slaves of the firearms that many have in their own homes. In the race war, more obviously than in other areas, the United States has passed the point of no return. And all that we can do is go on to a future of violence, bloodshed, and death. It is a war that was deliberately incited, of course, by the hypocritical agitation for integration. And a war that can now end only in one of two ways. For while the police and the army, if permitted by our local and national governments, can easily put down organized Negro insurrections in the cities, it will take a long time and cost many lives to suppress the guerrilla operations that have now been planned in detail, and to suppress a campaign of terroristic crimes against individuals. You must remember that the savages hate you because you are white. They hate you because you are the authors of a civilization that is repugnant to their native instincts. And they despise you because you were so stupid that you permitted them to vote. And because you are so stupid that you permit traitors to your race to prevent your police from maintaining order. Hatreds that have been aroused are now unappeasable, and they are no longer given even the most superficial disguise. As everyone knows or should know, a basic part of the civil rights program, although it was not mentioned much in public between 1920s and 1968, calls for the creation of an all-Negro emergent state out of American territory. And just a few weeks ago, an assemblage of savages in an American city formally demanded that the white swine be driven out of several American states so that the territory could be turned over to the blacks for their exclusive occupancy and under their own government. A territory in which, needless to say, they would be provided with all the comforts and luxuries to which they are entitled by the color of their skin, provided with such things, of course, by the work of the stupid white slaves that they will permit to exist in those parts of the United States which have a climate that is disagreeable to blacks. Now, to be sure, this is not a demand that our rulers will grant immediately, for the simple reason that if, for example, the Air Force were ordered to exterminate the white population of Alabama with poison gas, the Air Force would mutiny and refuse to carry out the order. But the demand, though premature, clearly shows what the next step in appeasement must be if we have become a race so degenerate that we can still think in terms of appeasement. I honestly believe, however, that you will find that a majority of the white Occidental population of this country is no longer in a mood to appease. If you are looking for recruits, there they are, waiting for you. Race is the fundamental issue, because if our race survives, you can at least hope that your children may eventually regain all that we have lost by our stupidity and folly. But if our race disappears in a mongrelized mass of brutalized fellaheen, nothing else will matter anyway. You will incidentally find that on every moral issue that normally concerns conservative Americans, race is one effective weapon with which you can strike at your enemies. You are concerned about the disgusting little twerps that occupy the pulpits of modernist churches. You will find that they are all racial perverts, driven by that odd mixture of racial masochism and vicarious sadism that animates their kind. You will accomplish little by doctrinal arguments with persons who still need to be told that those punks are propagating violently anti-Christian heresy. Strike at them at their vulnerable point, their perverted hatred for the race to which they were born. You are concerned about pornography. It now can no longer be controlled by any legislation, however draconian in both provisions and enforcement. It has been purveyed in the drugstores for years. Hundreds of millions of copies are in circulation. and the taste for it has been acquired. What would you do if you could now legislate just as you wish? Search every house in the nation for copies? Would you station a policeman beside every printing press? Would you have every mimeograph in the nation destroyed? Would you smash every photocopying machine? Would you then get into arguments about whether the Bible ought to be suppressed? That's a battle you have lost. It is pornography has so flooded the country that you can't mop it up. But you have one means of striking at the purveyors of all that filth, race. And you have but one antidote to the poison that has already been administered to our youth. That antidote must be an appeal to the idealistic tendencies that are inherent in the youth of our race. Christianity, I grieve to say, will no longer serve to inspire more than a few. That's deplorable, but face the facts. The one trumpet call that will stir the hearts of the young, so far as I know, is the call to racial loyalty. That sound is clear and unmistakable. It speaks to the heart, and yet it offers a perfect field in which a young man of studious turn of mind can demonstrate his intellectual superiority over the bumbling liberal hacks and aliens who pretend to instruct him. The only book that I know of that has actually inspired young men of college age is Francis Parker Yockey's Imperium. It is not a perfect book, and I have at least twice called attention in print to some of its factual and theoretical shortcomings. But it is a book that speaks to both the heart and mind of some fine young Americans, the young men in whose hands our future must lie, if we have any. Here again, it seems to me, race is the only answer to your problem. And I would advise you not to press all of its implications too hurriedly or too explicitly. Take care of that, and you won't have to do anything about pornography per se. I have tried to advise you objectively to the best of my knowledge and ability. It is simple common sense in war, as every military man will tell you, to conserve your forces and concentrate them at the points at which you can break through the enemy's line or turn his flank. My advice to you, therefore, is to keep steadily before your mind the objective of your strategy and to relate to it all of your efforts. Let me give you specific examples. Attack the United Nations? Yes. That filthy zoo in the glass cages in New York City. That zoo is filled with savages, and it is right now using your money and will soon try to use your soldiers for the unconcealed purpose of getting every white woman in Rhodesia raped and every white man butchered and eaten. Attack socialism? No. For one thing, that issue will involve you in endless argument and nice definitions that are almost certain to confuse or alienate some of your potential recruits. For another thing, you know as well as I do that whatever happens, even if by some miracle the White House and Congress were filled tomorrow with our people, say with the members of this audience, for there are enough of us in this room to fill all the controlling positions. Even in that event, I say, we would need for decades a centralized federal government armed with unconstitutional powers as or greater than the present rulers have usurped. That is simply a fact, and we had better recognize it in our own minds when we try to plan a rational strategy. That is the best strategy that I can suggest. If you keep that firmly in mind, you can, at least for yourself, bring some sort of order into the present confusing and chaotic scramble of innumerable right-wing organizations and publications. You can determine for yourself whether their policies and efforts contribute to the weapon that you must use in your to reach your strategic objective. Since I have said so much, let me presume to give you a corollary of the recommendation that you judge by effectiveness in this strike. Effectiveness in raising, creating, disseminating, or supporting your one last great weapon. I do not mean to deprecate any kind of activity that worries or harasses or distracts the enemy, even though the announced objective be impossible of attainment. But I do suggest that when it is impossible, we would do well to ask ourselves whether the energies devoted to it might not be more usefully employed, and if so, whether we can so deflect those energies without impairing our own. That last proviso means, among other things, that we never have any energy to spare for fighting anyone who is or who appears to be on our side. We may give him advice, yes, preferably advice couched in the terms that will mean most to him and will be least likely to arouse the obstinacy that is an innate tendency of men and mules. And if he will not heed it, let him go his own way. We exclude him from our councils, of course, but we don't have time or energy to quarrel with him. Take, for example, the most extreme and clearest case that you could imagine. We all know, of course, that our enemies are not stupid. They will therefore have devised pseudo-patriotic efforts to sop up money and energy, to lead people down blind alleys of frustration, and to thwart the realization of the American purpose. That is fairly easy to do. We all know the principal reason for the defeat of Germany in the Second World War was that the chief of all the German intelligence services, unsuspected by Hitler and unsuspected evidently by all the intelligent, highly intelligent and experienced military and diplomatic men who surrounded him, was Admiral Canaris, who was an agent of the Jewish Secret Service. You don't need but a tenth of Canaris' talents to deceive those who are willing to believe. All right, now suppose that on the basis of some secret information, which you have from a source that you know to be reliable, you know that you are dealing with a double agent. You know it now, mind you. Don't suspect it. You know it. Your first impulse will be to run out and denounce the scoundrel to all comers. Let me urge you, don't do it. In the first place, he is, even in spite of himself, doing some good. He is obtaining recruits that, if they become disillusioned with him, may come to you, come over to our side. In the second place, don't let your emotions cloud your view of reality. If you are indignant, you're indignant at the spectacle of all those people being misled and all that money being sopped up. You may want or yearn to see him boiled in oil, preferably oil from Israel. With that feeling, I sympathize deeply, but remember, you don't have a pot big enough for the celebration. You will find yourself involved in endless argument with fanatical worshipers. Remember that anybody who has talent enough to launch such a movement has the talent of inspiring confidence. And so, ladies and gentlemen, assuming that you know, assuming the most extreme case, all right, you will denounce. And what will you do? Through a nice, though bitter irony, you will actually have helped the double agent whom you, in your righteous indignation, are so eager to see boiled in oil. You will have helped him because you will have siphoned off to the struggle against him money and energy that could have been used much better on some object of importance to our cause. Such then, ladies and gentlemen, is the best recommendation for an overall strategy that I can present to you after long and anxious consideration and with every effort to attain complete and dispassionate objectivity. This obviously is not a suggestion for propaganda, sensational announcements, or public orations. Those are tactics, not strategy, and must necessarily be highly various, conforming to the local terrain and to the season and to the positions of the time. But all tactics should contribute, even though in ways that are not obvious or announced, to a single strategic plan. The most important thing is that we know in our own minds what we have to do and how we can do it. This suggested strategy is predicated, of course, on the assumption that you really want to win. Any historian can tell you what happened to the many nations that were too comfortable or too refined or too high-minded to fight for victory by all necessary means. The dust of the earth blows from their dishonored graves.
And now, a final word about the organization that made this series of tapes possible, the National Alliance. Your speaker, Kevin Alfred Strom. You who are listening to this tape, and I who produced it, do not know each other. I do not know how you came upon this speech. But what I do know, with a fair degree of certainty, is this. You share with us a concern for the future of our race and nation, for our children, and for our children's children. You share with us dismay and revulsion at the growing degeneracy of our society. You share with us profound misgivings about the wisdom of turning our beloved America into a third world slum. One thing that should give you some consolation is the fact that you are not alone. More and more Americans are withdrawing from the political process, believing it to be an exercise in futility, a farce in which the voter has no real choice. On America's campuses, the dictatorship of the politically correct is being openly challenged. Winds of change are starting to blow. With each new hate crime law, with each new affirmative action program, with each new interracial situation comedy, with each new gun confiscation law, and with each new wave of third world immigration, the vast and angry army of the disaffected grows. What then can be done? This vast army of disaffected white Americans presents us with an opportunity. But the task before us is immense and difficult. The power and money of the enemy seem limitless. Even taken as a whole, the patriotic forces in this country at this time are totally unequal to any contest for power. These cold, hard facts, unpleasant as they are, help us refine our strategy and direct our efforts toward what is actually possible. As Dr. William Pierce said at the first General Convention of the National Alliance, our task is not to persuade a numerical majority of the American population that we are right, but rather to build the numerical minority whose values coincide with ours into a majority of will and determination. For it has always been dedicated minorities that have been the makers of history. The majority will stand on the sidelines in every conflict until they are forced to act. Of course, these facts do not free us from the responsibility to recruit large numbers of people, many tens of thousands more than we have now. But we must always keep in mind that we are recruiting an elite, a vanguard group that will be able to build a professional organization and an uncompromising movement that one day will lead the masses of our people out of their slavery and degradation. There is much to be done. The National Alliance needs many different kinds of members. We need writers and carpenters, physicists and photographers, architects and actors, businessmen and artists. We need those who see the necessity of our task and are willing to give everything they've got to the effort. We need members who can inspire that kind of dedication in others, members who will lead lives of exemplary sacrifice and devotion. You may think we're asking a lot. Too much, perhaps. We do this because we are serious about winning this struggle for our people. We do this because we can't afford to waste our efforts. The stakes are too high. We ask for members who will bring real resources, skills, and abilities to the problems at hand. And we ask for members with exceptional dedication, patience, and persistence, because nothing less will do the job. Presently, the National Alliance has, through National Vanguard Books, the ability to inspire and educate the best elements of our people. We will continue this effort on an ever-increasing scale. We will select from these individuals those who are willing to become supporters or active participants in our efforts. We will expand our capabilities, not only increasing the publication and distribution of printed materials, but branching out into other areas, including radio and television. National Alliance spokesmen will appear more and more frequently on college campuses, on radio talk shows, and on television news programs. As our capabilities increase, we will begin to produce our own radio and television programs, to be aired on cable systems as well as on purchased commercial airtime. And always, the impression conveyed to the public will be one of strength, intelligence, truthfulness, and professionalism. I hope that you will subscribe to National Vanguard, and that you will avail yourself of the marvelous educational opportunity offered by the National Vanguard Books catalog and its recommended reading list. As you examine and consider the books and magazines that we publish and distribute, and as you hear the words of great patriots in this series of speeches, I hope you'll come to understand that no other organization has the skilled personnel, the seriousness, the understanding of fundamental principles, the fighting spirit, or the realistic chance for ultimate success of the National Alliance. Despite the decadence of our nation and our race's peril, you and I are lucky to be living in these times. Unlike the nationalists of Eastern Europe before the fall of communism, we do not have to work in secret. Our publications are not yet outlawed. Our freedom of speech has not yet been completely stifled. But if we fail, if patriotic white Americans do nothing, then all these things, and worse, much worse, are coming. If you think you have what it takes, then I'm asking you to join us. Whether you can best serve by joining your efforts to ours here at the National Office, or in the role of an activist and spokesman for our cause, or as an influential member of society, helping our work with influence and intelligence from behind the scenes, or as a supporter, providing the necessary financial and physical infrastructure that makes all our other work possible. You now have an opportunity to become a part of our great movement for the cleansing and restoration of our nation and civilization. Future generations, if there are any, will look with favor upon those who did their duty. Write us for membership requirements. Our address is National Alliance, Post Office Box 90, Hillsboro, West Virginia, 24946.